It's first a pleasure to be here, but it's really the first time for me that I give a seminar and the speaker is not introduced, but the audience is introduced. So it's a pleasure to be here. I think this is the longest visit I ever had to KITP, which is not a conference. And it's been a pleasure. It tells me again how long I was and I could have come longer. We have a mixed audience here, as we've seen, and the talk has different parts which are slightly more technical or somewhat less technical. I don't have to convince you that the LHC is around the corner and we should ask what we will find. And of course we don't know, but this is a good time to start in thinking about it in the context of perhaps placing bets. So what will the LHC find? So if I had to bet, I would bet on none of the above. So the LHC will discover something we have not yet thought of, basically because nature is a lot smarter than the people who study it, or her. But my view is that among all the proposals that people made, by far, is there a pointer? Yep. By far the most conservative, the most conventional, and clearly the most concrete one is supersymmetry. And since I do not know how to work on none of the above, I'll think about supersymmetry. Now, when we talk about supersymmetry, we have to be a little bit more precise. So during the last two or three years, I was preparing for the LHC and learning a little bit phenomenology, and I realized that what I call supersymmetry is not the same thing that other people call supersymmetry. So when I talk to experimentalists, for instance, for them, supersymmetry is a missing energy event. And when I talk to some of my colleagues, for them, supersymmetry is harmonic superspace. And of course, there's a wide gap in between, and which I think we ought to bridge. So in the context of supersymmetry, I'll assume supersymmetry is discovered, and so this would be a few years in the future. Some of the superpartners will be found, and all the dust will settle, and we'll understand what they are, and the error bars will get small, and we'll get a bunch of numbers for the masses of these superpartners. And then we'll have to face a much bigger problem. How is supersymmetry broken? How is the information about supersymmetry breaking is mediated to the MSSM? This is the known mediation problem. And hopefully we'll... Is there a better pointer? Yeah, this would work. And hopefully we'd like to predict the soft term. So this is a theorist view of supersymmetry. There's a whole formalism that I'm not going to discuss. Basically the first half of Wess and Bagger. Then how supersymmetry is broken, I'll say very little about it in this talk. How supersymmetry is mediated to the real world and predict the soft terms. And when we discuss the prototype of a model, is made of two modules, the MSSM, and some sector that breaks supersymmetry, and some mediation mechanism that couples the two. And if you look at the whole class of literally thousands and thousands of papers, they really fall into two categories, and I try to summarize the whole literature on one slide. They fall into two classes. This mediation is either gravity mediation or gauge mediation. Gravity mediation is really a misnomer because it has nothing to do with gravity. Gravity mediation is really the statement that these two sectors are coupled through Planck-suppressed operators. This has nothing to do with general relativity and with gravitational forces. Gauge mediation, which will be the topic of this talk, in this case, the fact that supersymmetry is broken is mediated to the observed sector by a gauge interaction, in particular the gauge interactions of the standard model. And there are basically three issues that these models have to address: flavor-changing neutral currents, the existence of dark matter, and a topic called mu, B-mu problem, which I'll say more about later. And you see that no model is perfect. The main point in favor of gauge mediation is that flavor-changing neutral currents are naturally suppressed. And this is a very serious problem for gravity mediation. On the other hand, these two problems are very easy in the context of gravity mediation but they are challenging but not impossible to solve in the context of gauge mediation. So this is kind of a quick summary of the situation, and there are people here in the room who know more about the subject than I do, so I would not spend too much time about that. So I'm going to talk about, focus from this moment on, minimal gauge mediation. And when people talk about gauge mediation, they really mean three different things. If you look at the body of work on gauge mediation, the most common one is the following. We assume that there is a superpotential, some chiral superfield X, which couples to what's called messengers phi. Phi are in a real representation of the MSSM gauge group. For example, 3 plus 3 bar and 2 plus 2 bar. And they couple to a chiral superfield X, which has a VEV. The first component has a VEV M, and the top component has VEV F. And X is viewed as a chiral classical superfield. We do not discuss where this VEV came from, and we do not discuss the fluctuations of X. So we just take this theory, plug the expectation value of X, and turn the crank. So just because supersymmetry is broken by this term, the spectrum of the phi particles, the messengers, is not supersymmetric. They run in the loops, and through that, they charge under the standard model gauge group, so they run in the loops, and that gauge, these gauge fields of the standard model field supersymmetry breaking to the rest of the spectrum. So this is a review of the properties of this minimal gauge mediation. The main point in favor of this scheme is that it's very simple. It's very easy to compute, and people have been computing it to very high orders. It's perturbative. It's very constrained, very predictive. In a sense, it's a little bit too predictive because it runs into a few problems with the data. And this is how the various soft masses come from. So here is how a gaugeno gets mass, a gaugeno of any part of the standard model. So I'm going to label throughout the talk by the label R, 1, 2, 3, the U1, the SU2, and the SU3 part. And there is a loop of these messengers. This is a fermion, and this is a scalar. These fermion and scalar have non-supersymmetric masses through the coupling to the X field. And therefore, we generate gaugeno masses, which are proportional to F, this auxiliary field divided by M. And there are higher order corrections here. Second, we discuss fermion masses. By fermions, I mean the superpartners of the quark and the leptons. And they arrive, get their masses at two loops. So this is a typical diagram. A scalar comes in the loop. A gauge field of the standard model comes here, another one here. And here we have this loop of messengers. We can have either the fermions here or the scalars. The fermions do not exactly cancel the scalars. And as a result, we get fermion masses. I would like to say, altogether, there are 8 diagrams that have to be discussed, the 2 loops, and with various fermions and messengers and some contact terms, etc. And they all give answers which are of this order of magnitude. So we sum over R for SU2, SU3, and U1, depending on the quantum numbers which run in that part of the diagram. And every one of them has an alpha square because of the 4 vertices, 1, 2, 3, 4. Quadratic Casimir associated with the group, with the representation of the fermion in, that we discussed, the fermion F. And it's F square over M square. And one nice feature of this formula is that both the fermions and the gaugenos are of order alpha F over M. These are 2 loops. These are 1 loop. But here we compute the mass, and here we compute the mass square. So the fermions and the gaugenos are of the same order of magnitude. And here is a list of properties of this scheme. Most of them are nice, but not all of them. First, we have the flavor universality. All the fermions, given quantum numbers, have the same mass. And therefore, the mass matrix is automatically diagonal. And since it's diagonal, there are no flavor-changing neutral currents. Second, the color superpartners are heavier than the non-colored ones because they have a factor of alpha 3. The others have only contributions of order alpha 2, which is smaller. Next, we have relations between gaugeno masses and fermions. basically, because we don't have very few parameters here, we've really parametrized the whole spectrum of soft terms with a very small number of parameters, so there are such relations. A terms are small. It's hard to generate mu for the B mu for the Degagino mass. In fact, the absolutely minimal version of the story that I presented on the previous slide doesn't generate mu or B mu at all, and we have to make the model a little bit more complicated to do it. The Gravitino is the LSP, so the scale of supersymmetry breaking is very low. And the NLSP, the lightest particle among the MSSM particles, is typically the Beano or the Stout. And there are a few other properties which are generic. Now,
small question. When you say that the core of superplasmas are heavier, you're really assuming that all the masses are roughly the same.
All the masses of?
All the masses of the fields. That the coupling was universal.
We can start and change that. In fact, there are tons of models in the literature where various features like that are modified. For example, instead of taking the messengers in 5 plus 5 bar, we can take several kinds of messengers. Another possibility is instead of having just one X-like field, we can have several X-like fields with different orders of magnitude. And we can try and make it gradually more complicated. In one of the motivations for the work I'll present here was how to avoid doing exactly that.
Yeah, I thought that the reason you had a 5 plus 5 bar under unification.
Yeah.
That's an assumption.
You can do it with unification or without. I'd rather do it with unification because preserving coupling constant unification is one of the main reasons for liking supersymmetry and ruining it here. For something which is not that crucial, it's perhaps not a good idea, but this is something which is worth exploring. I should also mention here that the Degagino masses, if we assume unification, take 5 plus 5 bar, and the Degagino masses are also unified at high energy. So their ratios at low energies are ratios of the alphas, and they come. All these are properties of the minimal scheme, and the purpose of this talk is to go beyond the minimal scheme. And that's for two reasons. So reason number one will come now. So logically, I'm really going backwards in time. The minimal scheme was invented in the mid-90s, and the scheme I'm presenting now was in the early 80s by these people. And they wrote a model like that. So if we just ignore that part of the superpotential, it's exactly as it is identical to the previous story, which was x phi squared. If we take the following model, this is an orthogonality model. It can be seen as follows. If we look at the equation of motion of x, it tells us that phi squared is f, while the equation of motion of y tells us that phi vanishes. So we have the standard clash between different f terms. So this model is an orthogonality model. M and f are parameters, and x, phi, and y are fields. And we take phi to be in a real representation of the MSSM gauge group, just as on the previous slide, and therefore y should also be in the same real representation. So there's some fine print here for the experts. This model has an R symmetry. We need to break it. Let me ignore that for the time being. So this is very similar to the previous case, especially if we look at that part of the story. It's identical. However, it has two new features. Number one, the mechanism that breaks supersymmetry is manifest. It was not manifest before. Here we see explicitly why supersymmetry is broken and how the X field got its VEV and so forth. So that's one nice thing. And the second is that the model is more economical. The messengers is not something that was added to a sector that breaks supersymmetry, but the messengers themselves participate in the supersymmetry breaking mechanism. So the model is a lot more economical. So these were actually the original models that people studied. And so that's it. So all the nice features of gauge mediation that we had on previous slides are still true here. The third class of models are perhaps the most appealing ones. So we talked about those where we have the only messengers, we don't care where X came from. Then we had these models of which are called direct mediations, because the messengers also participate in the supersymmetry breaking scales. Story. But we would like to combine that with dynamical SUSY breaking. So I'm not going to advocate dynamical SUSY breaking here. I'm sure you've heard enough talks about that. This is a scheme where there's a sector that becomes strongly coupled, and by dimensional transmutation, the low energy scale is generated. So in the mid 80s, the theme was to take these models that dynamically break supersymmetry, combine them, and combine them with some of the ideas that we discussed here with direct mediation, and have a model of the universe. My prejudice at the time was that it's so hard to do, there will be only one model that works, and once it works, we know it, this is it. But this immediately ran into a lot of difficulties. Okay, before I do that, I said again, the messengers participate in the SUSY breaking sector, just as before. They participate in the dynamics of the sector that breaks supersymmetry. So in that sense, the model is more economical. But even more to the point, the model could be so strongly coupled, the messengers could be so strongly coupled, that the whole notion of messengers is ill-defined. The theory could have no particles that can be identified as messengers. There could be some strongly coupled quarks there, which couple to the MSSM gluons, but these quarks will get so strongly coupled in the nonlinear dynamics of this hidden sector, such that by the time we come to compute the soft breaking terms, we can no longer use perturbation theory with these messengers running the loop. So the idea of messengers is ill-defined. So this is much more elegant. However, it immediately ran into the following difficulties, and that was already in the mid-80s. There was a problem of Landau poles in the MSSM, and I can really say now, if people are interested later, why every one of these problems came from it. It really follows from the general framework that we discussed. The models were extremely complicated, clearly hard, very hard to compute anything. There was a problem with an R symmetry that we had to stand on our head and so forth. But the Landau pole, I think, was the most serious one. Many of these difficulties are completely removed or become a lot easier in the context of metastable SUSY breaking. And there were some, I'm very selfish, I refer only to myself here. There were earlier references and future references that I won't give here. So this is a good scheme to follow. And we would like to take this problem back. Let's assume that we solve all these problems. How could we compute the soft terms in such a framework? So the goals of this talk is first to understand how to couple a strongly coupled hidden sector to the MSSM. So we have in mind some theory that becomes strongly coupled, breaks supersymmetry spontaneously, and it couples somehow to the gauge fields of the MSSM. And we would like to compute the soft terms in the MSSM. This is a well-posed field theory problem. How do we do that? And there was some early work by Markus Luthi about that. Second, we would like a formalism which simultaneously deals with all gauge mediation models. So when David asked me a question like, what if you change this parameter, I'd like it already to be included in the framework. So I'd like one framework which fits all, and we'll see what it gives us. In particular, we'd like to find generic predictions of gauge mediations, predictions which are true in the entire class of models, which I'll define very precisely, and predictions which are not true in the entire class. So for example, if we'll reproduce one of the features of the minimal scheme, that would be nice because it would tell us that this feature is true in the entire class and it's generic. If it's not discovered experimentally, it means that the entire class is wrong. On the other hand, we'll see that some of the predictions of the minimal scheme are not really general, and they're not always true, and they're specific to the minimal scheme. So I'm going to start with a definition. So here is the MSSM, and here is the hidden sector. And I assume that the only communication between the two sectors is via gauge fields, the gauge fields of the standard model and nothing else. In particular, if we set the three alphas, alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3, and again, R labels the U1, SU2, or SU3, if we set them to zero, the theory splits to two completely decoupled sectors, and which can be, so only these gauge fields couple the two sectors. So in the hidden sector here, I'm going to include, first of all, clearly the SUSY breaking sector, this gauge theory which spontaneously breaks supersymmetry. But if they are messengers, I also lump them into the hidden sector. So in the example of the minimal scheme, I view the messengers as part of the hidden sector. And that's why I don't care whether the messengers are weakly coupled or strongly coupled or what have you. In particular, it might be that messengers don't exist at all. There might also be other particles outside the MSSM. I just lump everything into the part I don't understand. So basically, we have the MSSM, and we say that the MSSM gauge fields couple to the rest. And there's no other communication between the rest and the MSSM. And we assume that this limit is smooth. And then we'll treat these alphas perturbatively and see what happens. So I decouple the two sectors. So the first thing to understand is the sector, the hidden sector. I'm turning off the alphas, and I'm only studying this theory. What do we know about this theory, the hidden sector? It's characterized by a scale M. It's not a conformal field theory. It's characterized by a scale M, arising probably by dimensional transmutation. And the theory is one behavior above the scale M and another behavior below the scale M, so M is the crossover scale. The theory spontaneously breaks supersymmetry. So that means that at very short distances, distances which are much smaller than 1 over M, the theory is supersymmetric and all the supersymmetric ordered entities are satisfied. But at long distances, distances longer than 1 over M, supersymmetry is spontaneously broken, so the supersymmetry ordered entities are not satisfied. This hidden sector theory has a global symmetry G. I'm not even specifying what it is, such that a subgroup of it can be identified with the MSSM gauge group. For example, imagine G equals H. So the hidden sector has a global symmetry SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And the purpose of this global symmetry is that we can later gauge it and couple. This is how the gauge fields couple to the hidden sector, because there's a global symmetry there. This is not really any drastic assumption. It looks like this is the obvious thing that everybody always does, but I wanted to spell them out. Yeah.
Since you're gearing towards generality, the first two lines, I'm wondering if that really is the most general thing that you would want to do, because you can characterize a hidden sector scale by some vector light, supersymmetry preserving that scale, and then supersymmetry breaking would have nothing to do with that. And then supersymmetry breaking would be at some much, much lower scale, because you have large separation between the scale that defines a hidden sector versus supersymmetry breaking.
Ah, so the hidden sector can include more than one scale M. So I would say the way I would think about it, there's one scale M, and there might be various dimensionless parameters. For example, if you have messengers in mind, the messengers can be heavier than the scale of supersymmetry breaking. This would be a special case, where the theory is still characterized by a scale M, which is either the higher one or the lower one, doesn't matter, and a dimensionless number that you can tune, and you can study the theory in the limit where this parameter is very small or very large. I'm not even going to commit myself to where is this parameter is very large or very small. There might be more dimensionless parameters in addition to what I said, which might simplify life. Most of the literature on messengers assumes that F is much smaller than M squared. That's an assumption, which might or might not be true. And then David could ask me, what if it's not true? So I'm not even going to commit myself to this one way or another. We can check whether what I say is true in this special case. But I'd like to keep it, in fact, that's the point. I want to keep it general. So that's why I'm not making any assumptions about that. So finally, we will include non-zero alpha. And then the two sectors will talk to each other via the gauge interaction. It looks to me like this is really very, very conservative. This is a slide that I can easily skip. The rest of the talk will go smoothly. But I really want to spell out the assumptions because they're so easy. OK, so now we finally go to work. So the hidden sector has some currents because it has a global symmetry, so it has Netter currents. And all the physics we need is captured by these Netter currents. So what do we know about Netter currents in supersymmetry? So simplicity, let's assume that the global symmetry is U1. Extending it to non-abelian symmetry is completely trivial. Global currents appear in a multiplet, which depends on four coaxes and theta and theta bar. This is a real superfield, which satisfies the conservation equation, d squared j equals 0. This is the superfield version. In components, it, or equivalently in plain English, this is the ordinary current, the ordinary nether current, J mu. It's conserved. And the multiplet includes also a scalar of dimension 2, which I'll denote by big J, and two fermions of dimension 2.5, or if you wish, a complex fermion, J, K sub alpha. And this conservation equation of the nether current follows from the superfield equation. And all the dot, 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 all the ellipses here represent higher components with more thetas, but they are all given in terms of these functions. So this is called the linear superfield. The linear superfield is a field satisfying this equation. And we basically need, in component, need to study a conserved current, a fermion J, and a big J. So from this point on, it's a completely straightforward exercise. I copied again the superfield. And now I'd like to ask, what are the two-point functions? So I'm writing all the two-point functions, and I take them to momentum space. And I'm using only Lorentz invariants and dimensional analysis. So I claim that these are the only two-point functions which can exist. We can have a scalar with a scalar. In momentum space, it has dimension 0. So we have a function C here of P square. And the label here, 0, is the spin of the operator. So this is the dimension spin 0. So C0 is a spin, is a function of P square, which depends on the dynamics. We can also take one fermion with its dagger. And that has a P slash and another form factor, structure function. C, label a half, because these are spin a half operators with coefficient function of P square. The two currents couple like that. It has to be transverse because the current is conserved. And we have another form factor, C1, function of P square. And finally, we can have J with J rather than J with J bar, which has epsilon alpha beta times M on dimensional ground, and then another dimensionless structure function P square. So I'll give it as an exercise for you to show that there is no two-point function between this J and this J mu. I claim that this is the complete list of two-point functions. Why isn't there a two-point function between this and that? I leave it as an exercise. You should submit it by tomorrow to my team. So these are the functions. I copied it again, and let me make some comments about them. First of all, the functions are functions of the dimensionless functions of P square. So we have to fix the dimension. We fix the dimension with the scale M. That's completely trivial. Furthermore, these three C's that we had here, here, and here are real functions, while this B is a complex function. And the problem has an R symmetry, so B is the only one that breaks the R symmetry. So again, very straightforward. So far I haven't done much, but now let's analyze and put some more input and see what we get. First of all these two-point functions are finite in position space. Those two-point functions are always finite in position space. All the divergences come from performing the Fourier transform to momentum space. In particular, we'll see that they are logarithmic divergences. We'll see that soon. If supersymmetry is unbroken, we can use the supersymmetry word identities to relate the three C's. The three C's, I remind you, are the diagonal elements. J with J, or J mu with J nu, or J with spin a half with J bar with spin a half. And B, which breaks the R symmetry, has to vanish. That just follows from supersymmetry. And since supersymmetry is restored at short distance, these relations must be true as P goes to infinity. So these functions of P square should be such that as P goes to infinity, this is true. However, at small p, P of order m square, supersymmetry is broken and these relations are not true. So what this says is that all these three C's, A labels either C0, C1/2, or C1, they all start with a logarithm coming from performing the Fourier transform. Some constant C, which is universal, independent of this A, log of lambda square over P square plus finite terms. Equivalently, we can change what we mean by the finite term and write it as log of lambda square over M square and have here a dimensionless finite function of P square over M square. And as I said, this is the same C for all three functions. And B is finite because it has to vanish at high momentum. there's no room for a divergence. Next step, we take this structure and we couple it to the MSSM. So now we think of the alphas as being infinitesimal. And again, I'm going to focus only on U1. How do we do that? Well, what we normally do is take the conserved current, couple it to the gauge field, and multiply by G. Because of supersymmetry, we need to have a few more terms coupling the other operators that we have in the multiplet. In superspace, it looks like that. The current times the vector superfield, and this is the coupling. And the ellipses represent various higher order terms, including various terms like contact terms, which are needed of order V square, but they are determined by gauge invariance, so we don't need to worry about them at the moment. So that's what this is. So now the point is that we're going to integrate out the hidden sector exactly, but expand in G. We have to integrate out the hidden sector exactly because we can contemplate the possibility that it's strongly coupled, and there might not be any messengers and so forth. It's a very complicated problem. But we can still expand in G. So continue to focus on the single U1. We expand in G, and we have all these functions. And to second order in G, we get the following four terms in the Lagrangian. C0 was the two-point function of this scalar J, which couples to D, so it renormalizes the coefficient of D square. C1/2 renormalizes the coefficient, the gauge kinetic term, and C1 renormalizes the gauge field kinetic term. And B, which was J with itself, the fermionic J with itself, creates a Gaugino bilinear. So it's really completely straightforward. So now we're going to study three effects in this Lagrangian. So we'll take this Lagrangian and see what it tells us. Let's start with tree level. All these C's have logarithmic divergences, which are this C is independent of the label A, plus finite terms. So that means that the beta function of the gauge fields jumps as we cross the threshold at M. So as we evolve to the infrared, we cross the threshold at M. Above M, we have the beta function B high. And at low energies, we have B low. And we jump by a finite amount, which is determined by this number C. Every single thing I say here has a counterpart in the case of messengers, but I'm formulating it here in the most general language so that we can see what's always true and what is not. This term originates from a blob like that. So a Gaugino comes in, we have a blob, and a Gaugino comes out. In the case of messenger, there is a loop here, a loop of a fermion and a spermion. But this blob, you see, does not have a line at the boundary because it should not be thought of as a Feynman diagram, nor should it be thought of as a sum of Feynman diagrams. This is the exact answer. And you just see that we get Gaugino masses, which is B at zero momentum. Let's study one loop. So I recall again the renormalization of the three kinetic terms. And at one loop in this Lagrangian, we have to study the following four graphs. Scalar comes in, emits a D. The D couples through this C0 here and comes back here. Alternatively, the spermion comes in, emits a fermion. This is a Gaugino, and we use here C1/2. Notice that the blob that appears here on the Gaugino line is not the same blob that appeared on the previous slide for the Gaugino mass term. The blob that appears for the Gaugino mass term flips chirality, and this one does not flip chirality. This comes from this renormalization. I'm pointing to these comments throughout because the literature is full of errors, which every one of them addresses a different error in the literature. There's also a graph with a gauge field here, and there's a contact term in the MSSM part with two gauge fields with a scalar. We do not need to include the contact term in the hidden sector. So we sum these things up. So what are we going to get? There will be one loop integral. So it's an integral over P. It will be the structure function from these four graphs. And if we work a little bit, so this is a little bit of combinatorics, and it depends on which gauge we use, we get different answers, but the answer looks like that. So the final answer for the mass of the fermion is a linear combination of these structure functions with some weights integrated over momentum. So we see that all the information in the hidden sector was before summarized in three functions of p squared. But in fact, we don't even need all the three functions. All we need is this integral, and that gives us everything. So we started from a very complicated, very general hidden sector quantum field theory, and all we need from it is a small number of numbers, small number of coefficients. Yes?
So this is a little bit of a technical question, but why is it that you don't have to worry about terms that are local negation fields and bilinear negation fields coupling to hidden sector operators?
Okay, that's already included in... Okay, so I'm glad you asked that. So in the case of messengers, you also need to study something like that. These are the messengers. So for example, you ask, what about this diagram in the case of messengers? Is that your question?
Yeah.
This is an example. Okay. So that comes in what I call from JMU, JMU. So JMU, JMU in coordinate space has a P, okay, I'll write it in momentum space. There's a P mu. Nu minus p squared a mu nu and some function which I call c1 of p squared, and there might be a minus sign to agree with my convention. When I write it like that, the contact term is already included. The contact term here is set. So one way of doing it is, let's compute the coefficient of p nu and adjust the coefficient of a mu nu such that it is transverse. So once I wrote it the way I did, that's already built in. Oh, there's another graph like that. Okay, so this piece is already included, and this piece is already included in this diagram. Because that part of the diagram already has in it everything. But this one we have to take in by hand because that's the part we have not done yet. But once I wrote the two-point function as transverse, I don't need to worry about the contact term. It's actually, this way of thinking about it simplifies the two-loop computation in the literature. This two-loop computation, I think Martin's paper is the most complete of the subject. This way of organizing the computation makes it a lot easier to understand. Ah, very good. It could diverge at short, low momentum, high momentum. You probably ask about high momentum. I'm going to answer this question. Okay, so this is the integral. First of all, these C's themselves diverged. Before we discuss the integral, whether it diverges or not, we have to ask about the divergence in the C's. I stress that the log divergence in all these have the same coefficient. That comes from the fact that at high momentum, the theory is supersymmetric. And the coefficients here are 1, minus 4, plus 3, so the log divergence cancels. That's nice. Also, the integral over momentum converges. So I'll first give a quick argument. And okay, I'll first give the quick argument, which is here. Imagine this integral had not converged. So the behavior at high momentum was such that this thing behaves, say, as 1 over p squared, this linear combination. Every one of these functions has log, and it could have a 1 over p squared, it could have a 1 over p to the fourth, etc. So the constant is the same as the log. The constant and the log are the same for all three functions. So the question is really whether the 1 over p squared is the same for all three functions. So I need, for the convergence here, I need that the coefficient of the 1 over p squared is the same for all three functions. So by now, we have a proof of that just based on the microscopics and the word identities, which I'm not going to present. However, let me give a quick argument. Imagine that it didn't converge. What would it mean if this integral doesn't converge? It would mean that our theory that we started with, which is a good renormalizable quantum field theory, needs another counter term. A counter term, which is a scalar mass, which breaks supersymmetry. Now, if supersymmetry is spontaneously broken, we should not have any counter terms which explicitly break supersymmetry. So this is an indirect argument that about these correlation functions. it's very indirect because this is a property of the hidden sector itself. We don't need to gauge the symmetry. We do not need to couple it to fermions to show that this particular linear combination does not have a 1 over p square. But it's still true. So this integral actually converges. The next thing which is interesting here is that the typical momentum in the loop is of order m, not very small. So therefore, when I wrote this effective Lagrangian with these coefficients, which were functions of p square, this should not be thought of as a low-energy effective Lagrangian. It's again another common mistake in the literature. This is not a low-energy effective Lagrangian. If you just go to zero momentum, you're going to get the wrong answer. You really have to do the loop integral. So if you want to integrate out the hidden sector and all the gauge fields and construct the low-energy effective Lagrangian, the typical momentum in the loop, the typical loop, involves gauge fields, which are in the MSSM, with momentum of order p. So the expansion is not an expansion in small p, but an expansion in powers of g, the gauge coupling. This is the only small parameter. So thinking in terms of a low-energy effective Lagrangian is wrong here. We really need the full momentum. But the thing is still under control because we expand in G, so it's enough to keep a small number of operators in the with their complete p-dependence. So now, after we have learned that about the U1, the problem with the U1, simplicity is U1, so now we'll do the full thing. So we're going to add the label R, labeling U1, SU2, and SU3. For the three different factors. And every one of our functions, C or D, will have now another label R, which current we're talking about. The current for the U1, the current for the SU2, or the current for the SU3. So now we have an option. Do we or don't we want to preserve gauge coupling unification with U1? If we do want to preserve it, what we need is that these three objects, this C is at zero momentum, should be approximately R independent. In particular, the logarithmic path should be the same, guaranteeing coupling constant unification. The finite path at p equals 0 will give us various thresholds that we don't want them to be too different from each other. So if we want to preserve unification, this is the condition. I stress this is a condition on the C's, not on the B's. Gaugino masses. Gaugino masses are given as before, but we just add the label R here and the label R here. So the Gaugino labeled by R has a mass, which are right here. And notice that in general, they are unrelated to each other. The Gaugino masses are unrelated, nor do they care whether coupling constants unify or not. For coupling constant unifications, we needed the C's to be approximately equal. The Gaugino masses are given by the B's. This is, in general, a totally different correlation function. So when people say that gauge mediation necessarily means that gauge coupling unification means that Gaugino masses are unified, that's not true in general, and it's easy to construct examples where this is not true. The fermion masses give us another surprise. So we take what we had before, but we have to sum over the contribution from the SU2, the SU3, or the U1. So we have a sum over three terms here, the alpha of the particular term, the quadratic Casimir that comes in the loop, and this number A, which is the result of this integral. So we started from a very complicated quantum field theory, we reduced the information to these two-point functions, which are just a small number of functions of p square. But what we really need is this integral, which we'll call big A, and it's labeled by R, one such number for the U1, one such number for the SU2, and one such number for the SU3. So all we need out of the whole hidden sector are just three real numbers, these A's. Notice also that the fermion masses are, in general, unrelated to the Gaugino's. These are the fermions, these are the Gaugino's. This is unlike the minimal scheme of minimal gauge mediation. So this is the formula for the fermion masses. And as I said, all the dependence on the hidden sector is through three real numbers. All the information is in these numbers. And now we get a bonus. We compute five masses. Scalars is a function of three numbers we don't know, and therefore there must be two linear relations. And it's easy to write these linear relations this way, some sum rules. The masses of all the fermions weighted with B minus L has to vanish, and similarly with Y. Now these two sum rules were written before in the particular context of minimal gauge mediation or various extensions, now we see that they are much more general. That is, every model of this class is going to have these two sum rules. And of course, these sum rules are valid at the scale M. We have to renormalize them down, but that's completely straightforward. This is within the MSSM. So this is really a nice result, because once these numbers are measured, we plug them. Okay, we round them up, and we check, are they satisfied or not? If this thing is satisfied, I think it's really a clear sign of gauge mediation. And if this is not true, then either one of the assumptions we made about the hidden sector is wrong, or maybe it's not a gauge mediation at all, but something else. So this is a really robust prediction of gauge mediation, the way I defined it. I have a few more topics which people often discuss in the context of gauge mediation. I just wanted to translate them to this general language because I find it more clear. More clear because it allows us to see if there is a difficulty, how to avoid it, and so forth. The first is Fayet-Leopoldov term. The U1, this object J, the spin zero dimension two friend of the U1 current, can get a VEV in the hidden sector, zeta. If that's the case, we have one more diagram like that, the one-point function. And that could lead to fermion masses, mass squares, which are negative. So people in this gauge mediation class, the people who work in this thing, usually want to assume that this zeta is zero. And this is usually achieved by imposing a certain symmetry, which is called messenger parity. You see that we can do it in general, and it's very easy to see, to write down models where this such parity exists. It's like charge conjugation of the hidden sector. So that flips the sign of J, and as such, it guarantees that zeta vanishes. So that's not a problem. A little bit more interesting is the mu b mu problem. This is the question of where does mu come from, the Higgs mass bilinear, and the soft breaking term b, which multiplies to scalars. And not only where do they come from, why are mu and b of the same order of magnitude, and why are these of the same order of magnitude as this fermion and the gauge genos? So one possibility is to put B by hand. This is not very attractive, but this is technically natural. This is clearly a possibility. Alternatively, we can add more couplings between the hidden sector and the minimal in the MSSM, coupling I denote by H, which will guarantee that mu is of the same order of magnitude. So we'll slightly extend our definition of gauge mediation to say that the two sectors decouple when I turn off this coupling H as well as the gauge couplings alpha R, and the two sectors really separate. So what can this coupling be? You can have two things in mind. First, the coupling H couples to H up, H down of the MSSM times an operator A. So this is one kind of coupling. If A times H times the VEV of A is mu plus theta squared B mu, and this VEV comes out of the hidden sector dynamics, then this will do the job. This will just give us mu and b mu of the right form. However, this usually doesn't work. It doesn't work because if A is a composite operator, then its dimension is larger than 1. And if its dimension is larger than 1, then this H is suppressed by some heavy scale, in which case these mu and b mu are too small. Alternatively, A can be an elementary singlet, but that's typically unstable against developing very large tadpoles, which could even diverge. So this is not very promising, although various people study such models. So this is kind of a large class of models, literally hundreds of papers, which study this thing, which I, in this language, can just put on one slide. Much more interesting possibility is to have two couplings, one to H up and one to H down, with couplings little h sub up and little h sub down, where these O's can be bilinears in the elementary fields of the hidden sector. So first of all, since they are bilinear and they can be charged, there are no dangerous tadpoles. So the issue that I had before with the singlet is not there. And mu and b mu, okay, so these O's will get VEVs, both first component and top component, and the O, various O's two-point function will get this, like that. and then we can compute mu and v. Now, unfortunately, typically mu is of order h up, h down times m, which is much smaller than b, which is of order m. This is the general version of what is normally called the mu problem of gauge mediation, which I managed to recast in this form. However, it's perfectly possible that for various reasons, we get mu not much smaller than b. This is some property of these correlation functions. And it's perfectly possible that we can get mu of order b, either a result of a symmetry or a dynamical reason, like anomalous dimensions of operators and so forth. I will not pursue it here. This is something I'm seriously working on. Once we have this coupling with the H, we also have other consequences, which are nice. So remember what we have in mind. We have a scale M, which is, say, 1, 10 TeV, so forth, maybe 100. And at that scale, we have some new dynamics, which is this hidden sector. This hidden sector also has four-point function. Why not? And that leads to various other operators like that. So the MSSM Lagrangian is corrected by various higher-dimension operators suppressed by the scale M. This is quite welcome because exactly this operator can solve the little hierarchy problem by lifting the Higgs mass. So having new dynamics at the TeV-ish, 10 TeV, is perhaps needed for other reasons, and it really fits in our framework. So time for conclusions. First, we presented a formalism for dealing with dynamical direct gauge mediation. We have a general hidden sector model. All we need to do is compute these various two-point functions. We found some generic predictions of gauge mediation. This fermion degeneracy, this is the main point in favor of gauge mediation, no flavor-changing neutral currents. We found two mass relations, which are true with very little input. The atoms are small. Mu and b mu remains challenging. And the gravitino is the LSP. So this part of the list of properties, I have another list here, this part is generic and it's true in this large class of models. Now, some of the other properties of models, which is specific to models with messengers, there are relations between gaugino masses. The gaugino masses are related to each other, they could unify. The fermions and the gauginos are related to each other. And there's a large hierarchy between different fermion masses. For example, the colored ones are heavier than the uncolored ones. All these are property, and finally, the Bino, the Stauer, the NLSP. This part of the list is specific to the models with messengers, while this part of the list is more general, and I think is more interesting because it could be in a larger class of models. So I think I'll stop here.
Trace y mf squared equal to zero. Was that only true at the leading order of g squared computations?
Yes.
Okay, because that would be altered at higher g squared.
That's right, but that's very small.
Okay.
Well, there is renormalization group running to lower energies, which you know better than I do. But higher orders in alpha with a hidden sector are really small.
Yeah. Probably
first one,
like I just want to make sure.
Well, it's alpha over 4 pi.
Yeah, sure.
And this is the scale M, which is assumed to be high. The renormalization group running is more significant, but this is completely calculable.
So, but isn't that result sort of an obvious result in the sense that at leading order of G squared, you know that it's going to be equivalent to the cubic anomaly cancellation?
No, it's not obvious to me at all. But it's true that algebraically, these relations follow from algebraically these relations are identical to the cubic anomaly cancellation, but it's not clear to me that the fermion masses are, each fermion mass is an additive contribution, one from each gauge field with the coefficients which are precisely proportional to the quadratic Casimir. That turns out to be the case, but I think it follows from this set of assumptions that I made. These two sum rules were presented as a surprise in recent papers. So I don't think it follows from anomaly cancellation.
Okay.
For example, if there is another contribution to this fermion masses in addition to this one. So I enlarge the framework a little bit and allow more couplings between the two sectors. Then this result is not true, but the anomaly is still cancel.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking in terms of you have y in this equation, you have y, and then you have this mx squared. At each of these points is our generators of the group, and all the stuff in the middle should be just sort of universal.
But that's the point of formulating it in this language. If you think in terms of messengers, it's obvious because you look at the diagrams. But if you don't think in terms of messengers, well, yeah, I think it calls for an argument that it's universal. The very fact that you draw a diagram, if the theory is strongly coupled, you say, well, you can't draw a diagram. So the point is that for part of it, you draw a diagram. For the rest, you don't have to draw a diagram.
He must be right. So that part of the diagram that contains information about gauge couplings is just where those curves.
Sure, but the rest of the diagram, which is not a diagram, doesn't have to be
some of the
of the hidden.
Or non-preservative.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. No, it's true. I can't argue that it's not true because it's true.
And in fact, as you said, probably proved this using worded entities.
No, what I proved using worded entities and I didn't present here is that these C's, have the large P behavior of the C's is such that the 1 over P squared cancels between the three different contributions. So the 1 over p squared is the same for all of them. That I proved using worded entities. That's for the convergence that you asked about. I say only two things. One is that there could be more couplings to the hidden sector, in which case this is not true. And of course you would say, yes, that's not true because there are more couplings. But this is something that you can test without even going to higher energies. The second thing is that when we started, what I really had in mind when we started is a theory which is very strongly coupled, and it involves some conformal fixed point, which later breaks supersymmetry. And at that point, it wasn't even clear to me how to start thinking about it, because there's no energy scale where we can draw diagrams, not even a Chow distance, because at Chow distance we have a conformal field theory. Organizing it this way, which in hindsight is obvious, was not completely obvious to me.
Okay, thank you.